Welcome back to Practically Intelligent. As always, we have your host here. My name is Sanan Osmer, and with me, as always, is the amazing Akshay. Today, we are talking to, we're very excited about this, today we're talking to Rajiv Shah. Rajiv has been, he's worked all over the place. He's been a data robot. He's been a Hugging Face. He's currently a snowflake helping enterprise customers and all kinds of customers make use out of their AI and their data as effectively and as efficiently as possible. So we have a great interview. So So we've already recorded the interview, of course, but Akshay, what was your favorite part of the interview? Because I think I have three or four different parts, but I'm curious what you thought.
I think this broadly just became a great reflection on the state of open source and what that actually means and predictions for where it's going. I think we get into a little bit of licensing and governance, but I think we actually sort of talk about sort of the business model at the end, and that was pretty fun to just project out in the future a little bit. And talk about some of the implications of this and where Rajiv sees it's going. What about you?
Yeah, agreed. And for anyone who doesn't actually know who Rajiv is, you should look him up. And obviously we'll have links to look more into him because he's on social media. He's out there. His presence in the community is extremely vibrant, right? He's such a good teacher. He's so good at talking about these kinds of concepts. And I think that really comes through. So honestly, I'm very excited for everyone to hear this interview because it's one of the times where I, as an instructor, feel really humbled to be like, wow, like this is exactly how I wish I could be presenting myself all the time. So let's just dive in, shall we?
Let's do it.
Rajiv, thank you so much for being with us on Practically Intelligent. We have a lot to talk about, and I'm really excited to get through everything on our list with you. But I want to start with some level setting. So, you know, longtime listeners of our show will remember that the landscape and trend of LLMs, particularly open source LLMs, for the past few years, at least, has been large to huge companies, you know, Google's, the Metas. They're producing open source LLMs or closed source LLMs. They're producing data sets. They're producing a lot of academic material. And smaller to medium-sized businesses act more as the consumer, right? They're consuming the models, the data sets, the academic research, and then they're fine-tuning it, remixing it for their own purposes. And that's been the general trend for a while now, but I want to ask you just kind of straight up, is that still the trend or what trends are you seeing now in 2024 about open source LLMs that we should be thinking about?
Yeah, so that gets at, you know, how do we get open source models? Where do they come from? And I think what you're talking about is kind of a new phenomenon that we've had if you consider the last 10 or 20 years of machine learning, where we see all these corporate research labs, right? The Google Deep Minds, right? The Google Deep, the Meta labs, that they're the ones that are predominantly dominating not only the creation of the open source models that we have, but also the academic literature as well. They're driving what's happening at these academic conferences with that. So there's a whole like political economy of like, are they dominating research like that? But to your trend in terms of like, who's developing the open source models that lots of us kind of that are lower down that are using them? Yes, those research labs are driving a lot of them, especially where the amount of compute and the amount of data matters for the models. This is why you see the most with the large language models. Now, there's still lots of universities that are busy kind of sharing out their models. Nowadays, one of the recent trends we've had in the last 2 years is just the amount of VC money that's flooding in, where you have so many startups now that are armed with a huge amount of cloud credits. We can talk about the nuances of, right, NVIDIA and funding its own cloud credits for companies that it's going back into it. But you also have some smaller companies nowadays that are building open source to get market share, to get noticed like that, right? It's become not only about kind of sharing for academic knowledge, but hey, is this a way that I can get publicity, right? You could just watch how the folks at Minstrel, for example, do their marketing as a great example of like how they've been creative to make sure a little company of right 20 odd people living out in France is being able to get worldwide attention for the models that they're building.
Yeah, I'm immediately glad you brought that up because in a lot of my own kind of consulting and lectures, when I talk about open source, you know, a lot of the talk track is kind of to your point, relatively old if you consider the past a few decades old, right? You know, you build off open source models, you have to add your own data to it, you have to define your task pretty clearly and succinctly and test it and iterate on it. But to your point, in the last couple of years, there's been a little bit more of a of an entrance to the phenomenon of using open source models, not necessarily to solve an internal task or even a task for your product, but sometimes more often than not, for the purposes of making a splash and getting known and saying, we built a model that can do X, Y, and Z. You know, and it's not even just companies you've heard of, like Mistral or Meta or Google. Even smaller companies who are you know, on their own face, an eval company or an ops company, they will make efforts to make news waves about, like, we built a data set that can detect or that can be used to build models to detect, you know, X, Y, and Z. And that is used as marketing, as PR, as inbound leads for their own needs. You know, once they arrive, they say, yes, and that's all part of our product that costs, you know, X dollars a month per person, per seat, per user, or whatever that is. So to that end, how does that affect the kind of supply demand, the growth of open source, and not just models and data sets, but as you kind of hinted at, how does that also affect the growth and supply of tooling and ops-oriented companies in the LLM space?
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to give a little bit of a step back and give a little bit of a historical answer. Like when I started analytics 10 years ago, right, you would have to go and pay for IBM's SPSS, or you'd have to go pay for SAS if you're an enterprise, if you wanted to do analytics. Like this idea of open source analytics and models really wasn't around. There was a small crew of like our people, but it wasn't until about the last 10 years what we've seen this boom in open source tooling for analytics. Now, this movement around the tooling for analytics has moved slow. You can think of things like sklearn that have slowly year over year developed. Companies have outpaced it at different points there. But really kind of what's blown up in the last 2 years is the open source models in the NLP space, because we've always been able to build models. I could build a Titanic model and share it with the world, but no one cares, right? Similar, I could have a churn model for my company. No one else is going to care because it's really specific to that problem. And what's happened is we've been able to build models for machine learning. We saw this first in vision where it had a little bit of an impact where we had general models, but we've really seen this in the NLP space where the model that I build, because right, I've amassed right trillions of tokens and an enormous amount of language, and it really is a robust understanding of language like that, that I can use it, but I can pass it to the company down the street and they can find a use for it as well. And so when we talk about this, right, there's a small subset really of all the machine learning models that are out there that are really worthwhile to have an open source model that you can get attention for doing that. And that's because they're solving these very generalized problems, largely around language like that. So to give the landscape, like it's really only a small subset of models. We it feels like, because we see it all the time, but if you talk to data scientists that work inside enterprises, right, most of the modeling they're doing is not with generative AI, right? 80, 90% of those tasks are still with traditional kind of machine learning models. So there is kind of this small set of models though that you talked about that are widely used, right? I built a new entity entity recognition, right? I can better at grabbing private data or grabbing company data out of text than anybody else. And I could share that out, let everybody else know, right? Put some benchmark scores out there on the website so people know, right? Maybe have a small version of the model that people can demo like that and use as a marketing piece like that. And that's all a pretty new thing to be able to kind of do all of that piece.
Yeah. And you actually, you're starting to talk about something else that we have touched on the show before. Actually, previously we've had Donald Farmer on the show, who was the face of BI for many years. Mm-hmm. And this kind of evolution, to your point, of traditional classical machine learning, analytics, data science, whatever word you'd like to attach mm-hmm. to whatever task you're doing, to this kind of new age, quote unquote, of generative AI. And to your point, again, as a consultant myself, I often get asked to build models, and the first thing in my head is like, we don't need generative AI to solve this task, yes. Right? You're talking about pretty basic classification. Now, will I potentially try to use an LLM like BERT, who is not technically generative? Sure, but that idea that generative AI is here to effectively be the panacea that we've all been waiting for in machine learning. That's an idea that I think has been thoroughly, if not debunked, at least it has never been really proven to any extent to say this is actually the thing that everyone should be using, right? You know,
I think as a practicing data scientist, I think you could hold that. I think if you're a member of just the public that reads the AI news headlines like that, it's not obvious like that, right?
Exactly.
The world itself has been sold on the importance of generative AI, right? As we're talking here, right? The NVIDIA presentation was just days ago and the amount of attention that gets around that piece. So I know what you're saying, but like, it's not the perception of everybody in the world that generative AI is only a small portion.
And you're right. I mean, and again, to riff on that a little bit, you're absolutely right, because people who are listening to this, people, you know, us included, it's pretty clear that, you know, what the media is portraying, what the mass public is consuming is very, very different from the kind of media diet that you might have, Rajiv, or I might have, or Akshay might have. In fact, we did a whole episode on tuning your media diet for this exact reason, for kind of avoiding these hype cycles. So I guess one question off of that is, what kind of advice would you actually give to someone who might be thinking, oh, this is the first time I'm hearing that generative AI is not the answer to all of our problems? What advice would you give that person to go seek, you know, different sources or to go seek different opinions? What would you tell that person?
I think the biggest lesson I like to kind of convey to people around this generative AI is a little bit about how the models work and what are their limitations. Because it's so easy to use something like a ChatGPT and which makes it feel like it's an authority. It has all of this knowledge. It makes it feel like it's really big and authoritative. You're just tiny, don't know anything. You should just be sucking in the knowledge like that. When the reality of it is, right, these machines, for example, they've absorbed a large amount of material, but the outputs that they put out, right? And people like us that are in the field know this, right? They're not truthful at all. They're just trying to guess what we like as the results. And they're not tied to any notion of physics, any notion of truth and facts. And this is something that I think is going to take a while for people to learn. No different than when the internet was first introduced, or Wi-Fi, or the iPhone. Like, all these technological things take a while for the heads to get inside people, to get inside everyone, right? It literally takes like 5 to 10 years for people to absorb the idea that when they use these models, it's not going to be the entire truth and they need to double check it and not do that. And right, like us at the leading edge, people are into this, know all of this, but it's still taking a while to percolate, where you have the lawyer that's asking ChatGPT a question and cutting and pasting that into the brief. Right? We still have far too many of those, and it's going to take a long time before people learn to stop doing that. And I'm not optimistic that we're going to solve the hallucination problem. So I think we're going to educate humans. You're going to have to understand, just like when you search the internet, you know, there's trustworthy sites and there's trust sites that you can't trust. Same thing. People are going to have to learn when working with generative AI.
Speaking of cut and paste, Rajiv, you talked about SPSS, SAS, the analytics ecosystem. Even, you know, if you look at prior machine learning companies and predictive analytics companies, largely closed source. And we had an interesting open source versus closed source moments just this past year, I believe this past spring, when the Alpaca team, over a mix of Stanford, Berkeley students, quantized and distilled the Llama model almost 2 weeks after. And it created some interesting side chatter. It wasn't certainly the main chatter, but about the future of open source. And was that right? Because we all want powerful AI in our hands to be able to be used for whatever our use case is. But was that de jure, you know, the ethos of open source? Was it truly open source? Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in licensing and how some of those debates are affecting the adoption of AI currently.
Yeah. And sorry for the history lessons, but I always have to do this. Is, you know, the world that we live in now with open source isn't the way the world has always been. I easily remember, I worked as an IT administrator about 10, 15 years ago. Open source was not liked at all. Like, nobody wanted people inside the IT of an organization using open source tooling. It was often seen as full of kind of security holes, legal issues. You had to go through a bunch of paperwork to do that. Like, the world that we live in now, where open source feels very widely accepted, is not necessarily the way the world works. And part of it is that there's this very tenuous relationship here between licensing, copyright, and other kind of modalities that could affect open source. So if we start to take this apart, I think there's a couple of things. When we talk about large language models, they're ingesting large amounts of information that is copyrighted. Like, should they be able to transform and use papers, books by others, and transfer that into the large language model? That's an open question. Are the outputs that come out of this, right? If you see this, especially with the image models, right? Are they outputting something that could be somebody else's artistic work or artistic style that could be copyrighted? On top of that, you have terms of service where, as I'm offering my model, I can give you specific requirements. And so it makes it a very much a tough web. And a lot of these companies and folks like Meta have kind of played with this also, where there's been exceptions for doing things for research, for teaching and education in copyright law, where, you know, if people are furthering the world that way, we're going to look, give them a little bit less of a hands-off versus if they're trying to make a buck. And so you've seen a lot of the research organizations try to use this research exception. And I mean, to me, it's not clear that, like, what Meta is doing is just pure research that's just trying to raise knowledge for everybody. They have a very commercial purpose as well when they release their Llama model to everybody to dominate the ecosystem where they can own like that. So for me, it's not cut and dry. All these like issues that we have around open source, and I can easily see a world where we have one or two slight court cases, we have one or two security breaches with these large language models, and that could significantly reduce the ecosystem and the willingness of people to kind of share these models out like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to dissect in there, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I have to explain this to a lot of people, where the idea that the purpose of what you're going to use a model for actually does affect how you interpret a license, right? Am I doing this? You know, I was a teacher for many years. You know, am I using this data for the purposes of a classroom, or am I going to sell this thing eventually, right? No, Meta doesn't, you know, at least not like OpenAI, doesn't really sell access to Llama, but that's a very viable business model for them going forward. Should they choose to put Llama 3 behind a paywalled API, that's totally within their rights. And maybe Llama 2 for them is just a huge marketing get to bring people there. So to that end, when we're talking about the ecosystem of AI, and not just the ecosystem out there, but even within an organization and using open source softwares, oftentimes the quote-unquote solution, or at least the band-aid to the idea of, are we doing things right? Is this the right data to use? Is tooling, right? We want something that can track provenance. We want something that can track copyright. We want something that can track PII. And that's for data coming into the model and data coming out of that model. But that itself can become a labyrinth, a behemoth. So I would love to hear, you know, coming from so many different environments, you know, Hugging Face, Snowflake, all these different experiences that you've had, what are some of the kind of concrete pieces of advice that you can give to someone who's really thinking about this open source ecosystem within their organization?
Yeah. And I'm going to tie this back to that first question around the licensing as well, because I think one of the things we're seeing with both on the tooling and the model side is that the creators can decide on the type of license they wanted. And for a long time, companies would either keep things proprietary themselves, they're going to charge for it, or they would use one of the classic open source licenses. Where nowadays, in the last couple of years, we found lots of companies are doing this middle ground where, okay, I'll let you use this model, but if your revenues are over $10 million a year, well, then you're going to pay, right? I mean, and you can see why, like, it gets some sense of fairness, or, right, like, hey, you can use this, but if you're using this to mistreat women, that's banned, right? Like, you can see why people might want to, and as creators, they might want to kind of be able to, right? They spent the effort building this thing. They want to tell people how to use it. But this is the other side of it, especially if you're inside an enterprise, and most enterprises really do not want to get into litigation. They're risk averse. They want their folks to use things that cause as little problems as possible. And it took a long time to get them to accept the open source licenses as well. I mean, again, like 15 years ago, most companies wouldn't let you use those open source licenses software inside a company. And so this is when it comes to thinking about your stack, that the easiest thing is if you can use that open source tooling now that has those licenses like Apache MI2, because they have the least amount of restrictions, they're going to get past your enterprise legal, your IT. You know they're going to be widely supported by the community as well. So I think that's an important starting point, is when we're thinking about the licenses. But I think the other piece is, we talk about the innovation in the space. And it's very hard to innovate faster than open source. You can do it for a little while for a small amount of group. But I always like to think of it like, if you ever watch the Tour de France or a bicycle race, where there's like a huge peloton that's always kind of moving, and you as a leader can go in front of it. You can go and maybe have a leading technology for a year or two. But if there's enough of a crowd that's interested, that's going to work together, crowdsource, cooperate, they're going to take you over. And this is where, you know, in the analytic tool stack, this is where I see over and over again, the open source just eating up kind of all those other little providers that are trying to build something differentiated as well.
And for those of you who don't know what a Peloton is outside of the actual machine, it actually means, my best friend is a huge Tour de France fan. And apparently it literally means like a group of bikers in a conglomerate. I did not know that before he told me. Amazing. I think that the big question then, I mean, not even question, like when you talk about, very first of all, like probably the one of the clearest ways I've ever really heard explained, when you're talking about trying to get the licenses, you know, past your legal team or past your IT team, that for a lot of people, that's step zero, right? Mm-hmm. We're zero indexing.
Yep.
That's step zero. Getting it past, you know, your internal team to say, go ahead. Because once that happens, you now have to figure out, okay, well, what am I going to do with this model? Am I going to use it as is? Am I going to put more data into it through some fine-tuning process? What are the implications of that? You know, the easiest one that most people, maybe not most people, but a majority of people have probably been through, if they've been on an open source team or a team that's used open source models at any point in the last several years, is, well, what kind of data are we allowed to fine tune this model with? Can I use data from client A and client B in the same model? So, and that usually has to go past a round of IT and legal as well. I've done that countless times. So are those just similar conversations to you, or is there something more to think about once you actually have the thumbs up to use open source? What's the next line of offense you have to get past?
Yeah, I mean, I think you answered it pretty nicely there, right? To improve upon that model, if you're going to use your own data, you're going to have to deal with the data governance inside your own organization for how that is. And right, there's, you know, all types of rules like that. And that's the training. And then you get over to the inference side, where somebody's going to read that security white paper about, hey, we extracted some information from the model. And so then they're going to be like, well, how are you going to use this model? Because we trained it on client A's data. If client B is doing inference on it and they can pull client A's data in there, how are you going to protect that? And so you can see that, you know, if you start really thinking about all the risks, there's a lot of risks. And this is where that data governance, understanding your data provenance, what actually is inside that model, becomes really important.
And even more than provenance, I mean, to that example, you know, client A, let's say client A's data was put into the model, and client B is somehow able to extract that information through, you know, prompt injection or through some just really clever.
If I was client A, how would I do that?
If I were client A, what would you say is my business model and roadmap for the next 3 years or whatever? You're absolutely right. So so even after provenance, even after figuring out what data you're quote unquote allowed to use, you're still susceptible to these kinds of, you know, you can call them attacks or just vulnerabilities.
Yep.
So coming back to tooling, and again, this ecosystem of what we're supposed to think about, what can you do? What are some practical things that people can put in place and think about to, I mean, even if it's the last line of defense, doing some output validation, like what can companies and people do about that?
So I think one of the things we're struggling with is when we talk about, I think there's a specific set of security risks and issues with these generative models versus traditional machine learning, where the outputs were, right, yes, no, right? Is it category A, B, or C? We knew that, right? With generative image, audio, text, right? Like they can create a ton of stuff that you haven't seen before that has a lot of risk. So I think one piece is they're creating a whole new set of risks that we're still trying to navigate to figure out how can we actually handle these. And you see different tools, like I'm going to red team the model. So we're going to actively attack the model in all these different risky scenarios to see what happens to do that. Or I use a second model as a guardrail to kind of watch what's going on around this model. And so I think we're still kind of feeling this out like that. You know, so on the one hand, it's a little bit of a scary place to be because there's so many things that you have to think about like that. So when we're thinking about the tooling stack here, this is, again, where there's lots of different players that are putting out different solutions. My thing is, like, this is moving so fast. Like, I mean, a year ago, GPT-4 was released, right? A year before that, like, it was like, I think you were stuck using something like Bloom if you wanted a large language model. I mean, we're moving very fast. And if you look at techniques, like, how do I fine-tune a model, for example? Those underlying techniques are changing really fast. So for me, it's hard to make a commitment to any specific technology because I know 3 months from now, 6 months around, if you're in the generative AI, like the world is going to change and that technology, that solution better be able to modify and stay up with it because otherwise it's just going to be ancient history.
I wanted to focus exactly on that, on trend lines and incentives. Maybe versus some of the snapshots. When I look at what we're seeing in open source versus closed source, so essentially an OpenAI versus and some major well-funded providers versus open source, is there tends to be a lag, typically if it seems like anywhere from 9 to 18 months in performance, that may accelerate, that may change. But I'm also seeing some interesting incentives, which is if you looked at Databricks with DALL-E or your prior employer, Rajiv, is there's this incentive to leverage open source to increase developer market share or engineering market share, right? So you look at these incentives, which is you see essentially this 18-month delay and an ability to, for everyone, an incentive for a lot of different competitors to want to open source their models. And so when I look at different licensing terms or security, they almost seem almost as blips on a bullet train where everyone wants to have their open source foundation model, their ecosystem of developers, their valuation depends on it, et cetera. And I look at that and I say, the licensing terms may change, but we may end up in a regime that largely, if you look at, you know, what has happened in open source software, has, you know, standard Apache license and then managed services providers, et cetera, on top of that. Is that similar or what you see emerging in AI? Are there nuances and new licensing changes that can emerge? How is our relationship with open source going to change with those incentives? It just feels like, as opposed, like you said, to 10 years ago or even five, six years ago, there was no Databricks. It wasn't clear that open source was a viable model, business model. You know, a bunch of open source companies, Confluent had yet to go public. HashiCorp wasn't public. Yeah. And so it feels like open source has just become this incentivized train for folks to capture market share and bootstrap their business models. But I'm curious if there's one or two things around the corner that you see slowing that or nuances you see emerging that people aren't paying attention to. Obviously, we talked about licensing, but if there's anything else.
There's a lot there, right? This is the kind of the open source versus others. And there's a lot of dimensions to this, but there's a couple of things that I want to kind of highlight in this. First is, what's the development speed, right? We see OpenAI in front. Does that always mean proprietary is better than open source? And I think it's not necessarily true in every area. I think one of the things that's really different about this area is, for example, OpenAI has had the lead for many years, right? They've had a good, smart team working on this. So they've been able to build, right? They have their talent, but they've been able to build high quality data better than anybody else. And they have access to enormous amounts of compute. And so to be able to best them, you have to do that. But then on the other hand, right, you have Meta, which is now, and we'll see what Google does, but Meta is going to release high quality large language models. They've started a little bit farther behind, but we know they have access to compute. We can assume they have access to pretty good quality data. And so we're going to see a model that's good, might not beat OpenAI, but it's going to clear out the market of other competitors for large language models, right? And so that's one of the things that's happening is only the best large language models, because they're very general, make sense to have. I have companies knocking on my door, you know, asking me to talk about their large language models. And I'm just like, what are your benchmarks compared to Mistral or you know, GPT-4? Like, if you can't tell me a story that it's better, like, what good is it? And so I think one thing is we're really clearing out the space by having these. And the only way OpenAI can succeed is if they stay ahead of Meta, right? Otherwise, literally, there's no value in the company if Meta can provide a higher quality model. I mean, maybe they can hit some niche, but like the existence of OpenAI depends upon staying ahead of the open source like that. So I think, you know, there's one element there that came out. You had a couple of other dimensions to this. And I'm trying to think like how to work the licensing into the talk. I think, you know, one of the things is what's going to keep these companies ahead. And I think the licensing is an important piece because Meta, for example, doesn't release their training data because they know that there's legal issues associated with that. So the laws could easily affect the nature here. The security issues could affect how much they're going to open source. Liability could, right? Somebody uses a Google model, does something wrong and decides to sue Google and the court upholds that, that could restrict down the availability of open source. So I don't think it's a granted that this current regime of like where you have these companies putting out these models is going to last forever in that way. Okay, there's a lot more thoughts like that, but let me pause here and see if there's pieces you want me to address on.
No, I think it's really interesting. I think it's actually that you're going to get a huge hauling out of the market. And in fact, I think this model-based open source development is actually worse for a lot of companies because it's not like underlying developer tools where you're connected to and bundled. So Kafka's bundled or, you know, to Confluent, et cetera.
Yes.
So you have some developed managed service, whereas a model is functionally and, you know, much more API-like and much more composable. Yeah. And detachable. And so I actually completely agree with your thesis that I think we're seeing this open source boon largely driven by, you know, this, it could be a bubble, it could be, you know, whatever you want to call it, but I'm very nervous to say it is you're going to see this much activity in, you know, around Falcon, around the latest, you know, latest and greatest, but these mid-tier of companies training their models.
Yeah.
In the future.
It's like Twitter releases a model and nobody's going to actually use it, right? Like Twitter gets or X gets attention because of that. But I think the other part is like, what's the business model around this? And I think your business model just around an open model isn't enough. Like if you look at folks like Databricks, like yes, they had an open source component, but they built an entire infrastructure around that, an entire way to make that experience easier to use like that. And I think that's the thing is, anybody can, you know, where we live nowadays is it's not that hard to build a better model, right? Like it's just a bit of compute and a bit of data. So you need a little bit more than that if you're going to kind of stay ahead of competitors. And I have too many thoughts coming. So that's one piece of kind of how you kind of beat competitors is, you need something more than a model. You need to have some other type of, right, the kind of the moat kind of around this piece. And this is where going to infrastructure makes a lot of sense. But this is where you have all the big infrastructure providers because they want you to run compute on their thing, pumping into this industry. So they're building all the tooling for this. They're building the models. And for me, this is a very large, like there's a lot of concentration happening in the industry in different ways that often we kind of neglect because we like to talk about all the little startups, whether it's Hugging Face's domination of the hub, or whether you have just a handful of companies now, right? About, you know, right? Snowflake, Databricks, and the three cloud providers, where most of that compute is being done for most people like that. And when you talk about alternatives to tooling, it's easier to just go with those providers' toolings for a number of reasons, because we talked about they support open source, so they support the common stack. Does your data science team, does your ML engineering team want to support model drift, want to support that stack? Or do you want to shift that over to your IT team? And who's your IT team used to working with? Those big providers like that. So I think, you know, this is another big trend that I'm seeing in this kind of industry like that.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of it, maybe you agree or disagree, but a lot of it comes down to kind of the age-old question of build versus buy, right? You know, coming back to the example of, let's say, Llama 3, even if Meta open sources Llama 3 and provides an API in front of it, there's going to be a legitimate choice of, well, let's assume Llama 3 is pretty gigantic and let's call it 100 billion parameters.
Yeah.
Okay. You can either download it and run it yourself, or you can pay the, you know, per thousand per million token price that Meta is going to provide. And one of those is going to be more cost effective for you depending on what you're doing. Yep. So to your point, a lot of that decision making is as simple as cost projection and as complicated as, well, you know, it comes bundled with the drift and the PII detection, the copyright detection. It's all bundled into Meta's Llama 3 API. Is that a fair kind of assessment?
It is. It is. And I think this again is leading to that concentration there. Because I think the other thing is that we didn't talk about is in general, like a lot of machine learning and AI that we're seeing relies on data. That relies on people who have vast quantities of data are able to use it more effectively like that. And we're seeing this already kind of with LLMs, where we saw this emergence of startups over the last year that were trying to build specific solutions for things. And now we see a year and a half later, the big companies, they've got their own in-house teams. They can kind of build this themselves. So you have Adobe can add its own generative AI solutions itself into its products. It doesn't, right? All these other startups haven't. And I think, right, because you have the talent, the infrastructure, all those pieces, it just kind of helps that concentration as well.
Yeah. So then one more kind of wrap up question here to that point, because one of my favorite things as someone who works in this space, not just writes and talks, but actually, like, you know, I consult for a lot of companies. One of my favorite things to do is to spend a couple of hours with a client and say, I'll sign whatever you want. Let me look at your data. Let mm-hmm. me see what data that you've been collecting just as a company for the decade or decades that you've been in existence. Because there might be some hidden use case of that data, maybe not hidden, but just maybe you didn't know how easy it now is to utilize that data with LLMs. And this kind of light bulb moment goes off for them. It's like, I didn't realize we could use our customer support transcripts in this way. I'm like, you absolutely can. And that's really a fun way to, for me at least, a fun way to kind of get that information across. So for you, what is the kind of the overall general advice or just practical statements that you like to give people in the space who are trying to get up and running with LLMs? Like, how do you navigate the first couple of steps?
Yeah. And it goes back to kind of first principles and exactly kind of what you're saying. And I do this in my videos all the time. I remind people that, right, like, to build good machine learning, to build good AI comes back to that data and that data quality and being able to collect the data that you care about, that, right, like, actually solves your customers' problems, finding ways to use that, whether it's traditional analytics or machine learning, but spending time collecting that right data, spending time on improving data quality, like, those are things that pay dividends that often, right, you see the big professor that's on TV, or you see the NVIDIA chip and all that stuff, but really focus on kind of those pieces in the end is actually going to give you a much better return on your time and money.
Yeah. Rajiv, you can find him on social media. You can find him on his website. We'll link to it there. Thank you so much for being on the show, because this is one of those episodes where it's just fun all around to kind of just chat about what we're seeing and what we're working on. And this has been so fun. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.